welcome to Boston Basic Income. I'm Alex Howlett. Happy International Basic Income Week 2020. Today we have a featured guest, Jason Burke Murphy, here for a discussion of basic income's prospects. How close are we to making basic income a reality? How far have we come and how far do we still have to go? What kinds of things need to change to pave the way for basic income? Jason is a philosophy professor and longtime basic income supporter and advocate. Some of us read a 2016 article by Jason entitled Basic Income as Proposal, as Project, and as Idea, in which he breaks down three different ways in which people approach the topic of basic income. As we emphasize here, basic income is just a regular income unconditionally paid to every individual person. I was talking to Jason on Monday and he said that basic income is like a Lego. It's a building block that can fit into all different kinds of visions for how we might want the world to look. That's why it has broad appeal across the political spectrum. With respect to the article, basic income as a proposal is then a specific proposed implementation of basic income, like Andrew Yang's freedom dividend, for example. Basic income as a project means integrating basic income into a broader vision or plan for the future, and basic income as an idea is about exploring the concept of basic income independent from any specific plan or political agenda. So that's kind of a lot of what we do here in these discussions. So with all that in mind, I'd like to go around the room and get people's initial thoughts about basic income's prospects. What will it take to make basic income a reality? We'll end with Jason, and we'll start with Derek, and then we'll go to Bethany, and then Richard. Go ahead, Derek.
Oh, gosh. Well, I wanted to say I liked the article, and I liked that. I think that's where, you know, this discussion leads us. It's navigating these divides that grow between basic income as a specific policy, and then as a project that you might be, or a justification that you might use to justify the policy. And the difference between that is just the general idea, the idea of basic income. Navigating that landscape is sort of how we're going to move closer towards going from wider awareness towards actual implementation somewhere. And I mean, I guess being somewhat new to it, all I can say is that I think I've seen a dramatic uptick in awareness about it. And however challenging those other difficulties might be, I'm pretty sure that just getting people thinking about the idea and talking about it is the first necessary step, right? So by that measure, I think it's more likely now than it's ever been. I don't know. I can't say for sure, you know, how soon we're going to see it. I really have no idea at this point.
Okay, let's go to Bethany, Richard, and then Neil.
Yeah, I really don't know what path it would take. I could see it being kind of like a thing that comes along suddenly, or something that builds gradually. And I don't have enough historical and political understanding to know which of those is more likely. Maybe even an expert wouldn't. I was interested in the article talks about certain proposals that have like a small sort of basic income as a part of their proposal, even if it's not their main goal. And that was intriguing. I could see that being a beginning to the idea of a cash transfer being normal for more people, the way that in Alaska, it's normal to have a certain amount of money given to you. And that could kind of normalize the idea and plant the seed. So I could see that as one way where, you know, one of the proposals I think was really about climate change and kind of carbon taxing, I think, and then to like handle the expenses that would come from things becoming more expensive, they would distribute a sort of a small basic income. So you could imagine something like that happens and people don't have to be won over to a whole new view of the economy to support something like that. But then people get used to the idea of just getting cash from the government and thinking of that as a reasonable kind of thing. And maybe that would be one way that building towards a larger basic income would happen. So that's one possibility, since right now the paradigm for most people is really different from something that would accommodate a basic income, although as Derek said, certainly less so now than maybe even a year or two ago.
Okay, great. Let's go to Richard, then Neil, then Matt.
Well, I think pretty much the only way we're going to get basic income is with some sort of disaster. And well, with COVID, that's like the best chance we have around right now. And like with Canada, they're getting used to receiving money from CERB, the Canadian Economic, I forget what it is. And they're just getting like $2,000 a month. And so they've been having it for like 6 months now or something. And so they're going to probably have to have it for another 6 months or so because of the COVID disaster that's going to happen in a few months. The whole, getting in the winter, being indoors, it happened here when it was in March and April when people were starting to get outside. So that's why it didn't get as bad as it could have been.
Yeah, it's going to overlap with the flu season. I hope we don't need a disaster in order to have basic income happen. Or I hope we don't need more of a disaster. But I guess we'll find out. Let's go to Neil, Matt, and then Jake.
I have hopes that they are basically providing a sort of basic income at the present time in terms of $600 for unemployment. And I hope that someone will notice that that improves the economy and doesn't deprove it. And if there are enough people who just take, see what happens, like me, that maybe the present situation will lead to something which is a basic income. Whether it'll be my idea or your idea or really general or what, I have hopes that the present situation will lead to something which is basically the start of a basic income. That's my hope.
Okay, let's go to Matt, Jake, and then Eddie.
Yeah, definitely hard to see from right now any sort of, you know, straight clear path to a basic income, but it does seem like it's moving generally from the realm of, you know, activists and organizers to politicians and policy. There's been a lot of discussion in South Korea. Spain just did something approaching a negative income tax. There's definitely been some interest in the UK. I think one of the main Canadian parties promised to add it to their platform. And, you know, definitely been a lot of interest in the US, although it hasn't really broken into the two major parties. But if I knew what the future holds, I would, I don't know, probably make a lot of money sports betting. But I don't. So you just got to keep pushing and hopefully we'll get there.
Okay, great. Thanks, Matt. We'll go to Jake, Eddie, and then Joan.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, today Jerome Powell, like the chairman of the Fed, was giving a little speech about like forward guidance. I mean, I think we're in like unprecedented macro times, like in our lifetime, and it does kind of feel like whether it's Trump or Biden, UBI will happen as some kind of like politically motivated. Like it won't happen out of a desire to help people. It'll happen out of a desire to like retain or like grab more power. But like, okay. I think I loved like Jason's article, how he broke it down into like proposals, policies, ideas. And like, I think like the idea of basic income, like having like a North Star is almost more powerful than like concrete plans, at least at the beginning. I mean, they're all important, but I think that North Star, that idea can like spread like a meme up here between people. Like I see my friends, you know, who a year ago thought it was freaking crazy and stupid and everyone will just be lazy. Now it's like, you know, it's a household idea. So I think that kind of thing bodes well. Yeah, I'll kind of leave it there.
Cool. Yeah, certainly a lot of change recently. Let's go to Eddie, Joan, and then Daniel.
I think we're at a very interesting time in history. And I think there's a dynamic here that goes on that is at the intersection of economics, politics, and history. I think that the prior analogous period was the Great Depression in the 1930s. And that what we're seeing is a more generalized form of Keynes's paradox of thrift, where, and this is, you know, my idea, this is not Keynes's idea, but where productivity growth continually deflates the consumer worker, and that eventually drives the economy into an aggregate demand crash. There's no self-stabilizing mechanism, first of all, to correct it. Second of all, the last time, you know, it happened during the Great Depression, we got monetary policy, fiscal policy, and the welfare state, Social Security, and things like that. And that brought us out of the crash eventually. So I think that what's going to happen now is that, again, things are going to continue to get worse. But the monetary policy is, you know, it's a little bit off. The targeting is a little bit wrong because it goes to the business community instead of going to consumers. And so I think what's going to happen now is that it's going to continue to get worse until it becomes impossible for everyone to ignore the problem. And in the very end, the politics will come around to where we get a solution to the problem when it gets bad enough.
All right. Well, I'm always hopeful for a path to basic income that doesn't involve everything getting worse. But let's go to Joan, Daniel, and then Jason.
Yeah, I actually agree with Richard that the pandemic has pushed it into awareness with the, you know, the deposit of a $1,200 stimulus check being done, where before, I mean, it was done pretty seamlessly, some glitches, but for the most part, people were talking about how does it get distributed? What, you know, how is it possible that, and how would we measure who gets it and all of that stuff? And then we see, oh, but in under this pressure, everybody can get it and it can be done. There's a mechanism to do it with. And the second thing I think that's pushing awareness of it is Andrew Yang's candidacy. I think that people became very aware of it through his, just through his candidacy and through his debates and the talks that he gave. And I think he disseminated a lot of awareness through that. I mean, he didn't win, but yeah, I think he did a lot of work on that.
Okay, let's go to Daniel and then Jason.
Yep, so I think a few things. One, I think that in general, it seems that if politicians don't do anything unless the people demand it and demand it of the people who are elected. So I definitely think what everybody's talking about with just having greater awareness will lead to more people looking for that in their politicians. And that's really to Andrew Yang. Now you have to have a position as to why you don't support basic income, as opposed to being able to just dismiss it out of hand as pie in the sky. And kind of related to that, I think another big hurdle is sort of in the Stephanie Kelton modern monetary theory vein of people, you know, the general population not necessarily being as aware of how government spending and taxation really works and thinking about the government as a business or as a household, as opposed to being this other thing that can do more with the currency that it has. I think that's another big thing to sort of just get more people to think of basic income, not just as, oh, I like it and it sounds good, but there's all these other fiscal concerns that I have, and people just being like, oh yeah, I like this and it's supremely obvious that we can do it. So I think that's, you know, kind of another hurdle. And then the last thing I think is just, this is, I guess, more of a personal idea, but I do think that basic income is not likely to happen in America through either of the legacy parties, the Democrats or the Republicans. I think a third independent party is more likely to be amenable to implementing that. There's a new third party that's starting that's called a Movement for a People's Party that I've been following for several months now, who just had their convention, and basic income is part of their platform. And they are trying to build a party that's going to be sort of an alternative to the Democrats and the Republicans without the sort of stigma of the legacy third parties like the Green Party and the Libertarians. But just having a new party where basic income is part of the platform, I think is great. And even if it takes 10 to 20 years to build it up, that's kind of where I see it happening. I think it'll be tougher to convince legacy parties to do that. That's, you know, more of a personal guess. And also related to that, my final point, sorry, just having younger people who I think are more aware of basic income and more supportive of it becoming a dominant voting bloc. I think that's the last piece. So I definitely think it's on the right track and it's in the best place it's ever been. And I think certainly within my lifetime, I'm 26, I think within 25 years, I think basic income would be a reality for sure.
Okay, great. Interesting thoughts. Let's go to Jason.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier when we introduced that I found basic income in literature from National Welfare Rights Organizations, a group in the 70s. And they're famous in that basic income looked like it was going to happen. And they mostly criticized the proposal that almost happened because they thought the next proposal will come soon and would be larger and better. Right. So kind of a scary moment when you're reading it as you go, you think, no, turn around. No. But that's how the idea came in my head, quite by accident, leftover stuff, because it was not in the air. I was in left groups and I was a community organizer and it wasn't showing up on the agenda then. So it's exciting to see this become a topic for debate among multiple political streams. In the paper I read, I was really happy to hear folks read it. And you're right, Alex, I've been calling it a Lego. I didn't call it that in the essay, so I probably need to write that down. But it's important to note it's one of those really cool Legos, you know, like the clear Lego that can make it a race car, you know what I mean? Like the with the angle on, you know, it can take something and make the whole thing have a different meaning. And it works that way as a a proposal, a project, or an idea, this division that I made. So if you have a proposal that taxes pollution and there's no basic income, I mean, we need to tax pollution, and future generations, including low-income people, need us to tax pollution now, but low-income people now will be hurt. So this LEGO really changes that proposal. It becomes an anti-poverty measure as well as an anti-pollution measure. As a project, there's something about the whole project. So if you really hate income taxes and you replace it with nothing, then you've just simply devolved government, lowered the budget, freed up rich people from the one of the main things that taxes them. But if you're replacing it with some other tax and it all goes to basic income, now we do a little math. We want to make sure it works out, but it's a different project. That wouldn't be one of mine, but that's a different project. And then as an idea, when I was a community organizer, I saved this for some of these occasional discussions with leaders. We'd get together and say, we organize low-income people in Arkansas and we set agenda items. We were known for being very practical. Fight for that stop sign, stop this bad. Often we were fighting sales tax increases a lot. But I wanted to, what's the whole thing about? And I would say, well, what if, you know, Martin Luther King said everyone should have a share? And how different would your life be? And it was a way to let them know that I thought differently of them than most of the people they deal with. Their employer, the bureaucrat, the landlord, the everybody who just kind of wanted to categorize every mistake they ever made. And I wanted to say, well, you know, if you had the share, this would be different. And it would work. It would help. People weren't, I was very hypothetical. So I got to see it work that way as an idea. And I found out later in Canada, where again, we are maybe the country most likely to do this, women's shelters, a network of women's shelters signed an agreement. It's called the PICTOU Statement, P-I-C-T-O-U. They, as part of their intro, like after you've spent one night or you're taken care of on an emergency basis, they have a poster that explains, think how different your life would be if you had a share of basic income. And they had to take time to explain what it was. I don't know if they do now, right? But it was worth it to them because a lot of people are going to tell them their situation's their fault. And sure, they probably made mistakes. They've been set up to make mistakes by a vicious world. And it's time to talk about how different it would be if you had a share. So that's where the idea came in for me. And then the stuff I'm working on now about the political prospects are mostly informed by that, but I want to let others have a chance and then we can get back to that. Because I do see some things about to happen that'll make bring on decisions, right? We're going to have to make some decisions as organizations and movements and basic income.
Yeah. So for me, it's interesting because most of the big important stuff that's been happening in the basic income world and the basic income movement has been on the political side of things. And for me, I've kind of always felt that the main obstacles to basic income were not political. They were intellectual. It was about understanding the economics, that kind of stuff. If you'd asked me a few years ago whether a presidential candidate should run on a basic income platform, I would say no. Basic income is not ready for politics. It's just not. But clearly I was proven wrong because Andrew Yang has had such a huge impact on it used to be that I talked to people about basic income and they didn't know what I was talking about. I had to explain it. Like everyone has kind of brought this up in the last couple of years. That is no longer the case. So the political side of things has really been driving everything. I still have like in the back of my mind and kind of in my heart, I feel like, well, I want people to be talking about basic income differently. And starting around 2013, I started to get very frustrated with the way basic income advocates were talking about basic income. And I still have that frustration, but they are succeeding nevertheless. So I kind of have to give them credit there. I think nobody has their hands up, so I can go to a quote from the article because or Derek has his hand up. Go ahead, Derek.
I actually would like to get into quotes of the article, but I guess I'll just say briefly that, like, you know, I think that's worth pointing out that there is progress to be made on the political spectrum. But then, you know, when I think Daniel was saying that, like, well, okay, maybe we can get a third party, right? I don't see it coming out through the two traditional parties. I mean, I think Alex's emphasis of the economics there is a path there. There is a kind of a cheat code in a way around some of these divisions over the political projects, because if you can, I mean, other people who just talked were also saying too, we're living in a unique moment for macro theory. Some certain assumptions about economics are kind of in flux right now, or there are certain ideas that are getting more popular right now. So if you're able to convince people that this thing, irrespective of the political projects, that it just makes economic sense, right? And it actually helps the economy from the traditional view of it, if nothing else, then that might be a way to supplement or even get around some of these political obstacles we encounter, you know, in that other realm. And that is something that might be available and might be a way to avoid waiting for, you know, further catastrophe or more dramatic political fights to occur before implementing it.
Yeah, I like that. And I think that's probably right. If we all get a handle on what this Lego is, what are we talking about here? What does it do? What does it add to the various projects that you might be talking about? If we all share the same understanding of basic income and understand that it helps you no matter what your project is, because it's this fundamental thing that makes things work, right? Whatever you want politically, you want a functioning economy where consumers can buy stuff and it can be efficient in that way. So I think these two can be synergistic. You can have the political movement and that can get more people thinking about basic income, but then it can also get more people thinking about how basic income works and kind of the fundamental economics of basic income and all of that stuff as well. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Bethany, because she teaches at a university, I believe, correct? Do you know if basic income is being talked about as being added to any kind of curriculum at a higher education level, even just talking about it in a college environment? When I was in college a few years ago, definitely was never brought up. I studied economics. So I was just curious if there's any movement on that in that front.
Yeah, good question. So I don't teach in an economics department. I teach in two other departments, psychology and human evolutionary biology. So I wouldn't know directly. I would say that students are more aware of it since Andrew Yang's campaign, just colloquially, as everyone's been saying. And I know people with PhDs in economics, they're not directly working on the curriculum. I think it's become more prominent for them as well, but I haven't heard anything about it. Oh, you know what? I have one exception to what I just said. There was a class on cooperation taught in the psych department that included a discussion of basic income. It was a broad class, so it was cooperation from, you know, cells to AI, kind of. And so they were trying to take the discussion in a lot of different places. And I think towards the end, maybe with the discussion of automation is where it kind of came in, but I know that I was interested in seeing that they had basic income on the syllabus in that class. So I guess that is an example of it showing up, not in an economics class, but as a proposal that's been talked about.
One part of this that is still underorganized, and so we do have we kind of know there's a lot, in a way there's so much that still needs to be done. People can kind of do what they want still with basic income. And a few pieces that are really hard to do are starting to happen. But on the academic side, US Basic Income Group founded mainly to just have a conference once a year. And then we started adding a few other things. I went and grabbed the Facebook page. I have a funny story behind that. Basic Income Earth Network, I looked it up, Facebook. This is when it was kind of fun and you were just finding out who you went to high school is still alive. It was that period. And Basic Income Earth Network was a page that we didn't know the name of the person who started it. And it was nothing but videos of clouds. Yeah, and it was no text, nothing. And I'm working with Basic Income Earth Network and I write him a little note. Hey, just wonder if I'm on the board of Basic Income Earth Network. I didn't say this is our name, and I decided to take it easy. I got an all caps. If you don't, he somehow read between the lines here. If you don't know what I'm doing, you don't understand basic income, you know. And I thought, oh man, if I say more to him. And eventually he, for some reason, dropped the page, and then I grabbed it. So I initially founded these pages just to hold them, so make sure they get in the hands of the right people. But that's how obscure the space was. I mean, I was Google searching basic income and not getting new things every day. Like I would go, oh, something was written. And I'm talking, this included blogs, you know, so I would find something and decide whether to share it. And I was willing to share almost anything that mentioned it. And so we know that's not, I mean, I think we needed to do that then. We needed to just amplify, get the word out and the definition in the public sphere. And then it was more academic in our conferences. The website was so old fashioned till recently, it was almost getting cool. I briefly thought maybe we should keep this 2003 look, you know, that the website has. And again, that's becoming a project, right? And so as we're looking for more things that are co-sponsored, like this discussion, I think there's so much room for these to get larger, but I would love to see something on our website that had ways to teach basic income. text assigned, sample questions in class, some of the stuff that actually not enough college professors do for each other. Actually, we should help each other out with more. Some of the things that K through 12 and educators do for each other. If you teach tax policy, I knew someone who, that's what he did. He taught negative income tax in an accounting class, and he got a lot out of it. I loved teaching it because it disrupted political philosophy classes. There were conservatives who were anti-bureaucratic, but wait a minute, this isn't bureaucratic. So now what do I believe? There were liberals who thought, whoa, wait a minute, no. We need somebody following them around, telling them what to do. Yeah, and it really did. It wasn't obvious who was going to back which one. And that was fun for class. I'm noticing that that's starting to no longer be as dependable. Basic income is starting to get filed now under a sort of PowerPoint slides that are left, right, liberal, et cetera, right? And this is a product of it being better known, but it's being typed by most of my students. They've heard of Yang, Democrat. They may have perceptions of whether he's centrist, liberal. Actually, that swings wildly. Some say he's the most left-wing candidate. Some say he's the most centrist candidate. You know, all that's mostly projection based on his personality or the policy. But that's new. That could be, we could end up in a moment where one of our political streams has some ownership of this issue, Green New Deal. Biden can't say he supports Green New Deal because that's sort of owned by something left of what he wants to say he is. Medicare for all, he can't say he backs it, right? And basic income, by its definition, it's hard to just say you don't support it, then go do it because it's so well defined, right? If you say you don't support basic income and you issue everybody a regular check, gotcha. So having it owned by one of these streams, I worry a little bit about, even though it's more likely to happen once it is.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I like the idea that it can just be something that catches people off guard, and there are elements of it that appeal to different political perspectives. But if you're, yeah, once it becomes more politicized, you're right, it's going to be associated with more with particular projects. A lot of times, kind of like what you were mentioning in your article, was that if people liked basic income, they could always find a project that was compatible with their politics that had basic income in it. But if they didn't like basic income, they could find a project that was not compatible with their politics and point to that and say, I don't like that. Right. So it's an interesting question. Is there any way that we can maybe prevent that from happening, or prevent it from getting siloed into a single political project or affiliated with one particular political party or something like that? Or is that inevitable? So let's go to a quote from the article. This is one of my favorite quotes, which is why I picked it first. So we have to talk about basic income now so that anti-poverty activists do not oppose it. So this is a very interesting phenomenon, because if you understand basic income, or if you understand basic income the way many of us do, naturally we think of it as this, you know, it's going to have this huge anti-poverty effect. Yet there are a lot of anti-poverty activists who do oppose it. So why is this happening, and how do we shift the narrative so that the anti-poverty movement is more aligned with kind of the basic income thinking? So let's go to Matt.
Yeah, I actually wanted to just go back to what Daniel had asked about, you know, with basic income at colleges and universities. So last fall, I took Harvard's introductory economics class, and they do talk about basic income there. This was the first year with two new professors. I forget one. One is Jason Furman, who worked under Obama. And so he's still pretty influential in the field. And so I'm not sure if that was part of the curriculum before they came in. The previous professor was Gregory Mankiw, who wrote an op-ed saying he preferred the freedom dividend to a wealth tax. So for whatever that's worth. So yeah, they did talk about basic income. I think they were pretty skeptical of it. Definitely going back, there's a lot that I've learned since then that I would have considered very differently, you know, in terms of empirical research and in terms of how government spending works, that I think that they get wrong. But yeah, I mean, it's in the discussion, which is good. I mean, I just think that the more you mention it, the more sane it's going to seem. And so, you know, just talking about it more in any context is going to get people used to the idea. And I think that's the first step to getting them on board.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. There's a huge visibility component to it. Let's go to Richard.
A lot of left anti-poverty people are against basic income because they think it would replace all these programs like SNAP, or, which is food stamps, or like fuel assistance and all these other 130-something programs or whatever it is. And they think that these programs are so great, but you have to refile for them all the time, and you have to prove this or that your income is so good, so low, or... But with basic income, you don't need to prove much of anything, just that you're a citizen maybe, or and that you're of certain age, whatever that might be. And then you get a floor, and you don't have to, you don't need to worry about a net that you fall through, like last week's topic. And so you just build upon that building block or Lego, and you can just go above that. You don't have to worry about, oh no, I have starting this company, so I have to save up so much. But you can just go bare bones about it. Like, I think it was Elon Musk who said he learned how to survive on $1 a day or something, and that so you could do $300 or $100 a day or something like that with basic income, or is it 30, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I have a feeling that maybe basic income is a Lego is going to be a meme that comes out of this conversation, thanks to Jason. And maybe Derek can pull together all the clips of people referring to basic income as a Lego and put together a video of that.
Lego.
Yeah, there you go. There's more content. Yeah, go ahead, Jason.
If Elon Musk ever lived on less than 50, $100 a day, I will go grab a hat out of this closet and I will eat it on Zoom live. All right, but anyway, but yeah, you're right. I mean, this, if we don't talk about basic income from our understanding, right, we want to see something that knocks poverty back, eventually want to see poverty abolished, and we think basic income's a necessary component of that. That idea has to get out, and I wrote this article pre-Yang, who I think helped here. People looked into, whoa, wait a minute, value-added tax, what's that going to do, da-da-da-da-da, right? And he got in the debate. The bottom, look, 94% of Americans are going to come out ahead on this. And committing to that kind of progressiveness is going to help here. But yeah, when Sam Harris says, once there's a basic income, we don't have to care about anyone anymore, right? Yeah, that's what he said, right? In other words, that doesn't fit my understanding of a project, right? I'm looking forward to solving problems in a world with basic income in it. I think it's going to release charities. I think it's going to release people that want to make things better. I think schools in low-income neighborhoods will be able to start thinking about whole new ways to pitch in and help. And the idea, I just can't imagine not getting excited, right, about making things better instead of saying, hey, we already give you $1,000 a month. I mean, I don't want to hear about potholes in your neighborhood or health, education. I don't want to hear about that. To me, that's incongruent, but that is the project that's out there. Yang, I think, helped a lot by having a proposal, a tax policy, and we're going to see more of those. We're going to see more a couple supporters in Congress after these elections. I don't know who's going to win or what's going to happen, but you look at Humanity Forward, which has a list of endorsed candidates. And by the way, politically, we never had that. It takes hours to verify if a candidate or a member of Congress supports basic income. And it really takes a debate to determine what criteria you use for that. So Humanity Forward, I think, just used Yang's criteria. He asked them and found out who supports it, who doesn't. But we have several primary winners. Many of them are in very red districts and aren't going to win. But we're going to see. We just need a couple people writing bills. That helps us project the idea in some ways, because it's natural to ask, what's the catch? Let's have a basic income. I'll give you an example. Mike Huckabee had a proposal in when he was running for president. It's like a $20,000, he called it a prebate, or it was a fair tax proposal that would have a big sales tax, get rid of the income tax, and issue this large grant. And well, what's the catch? The catch is really high sales taxes. And you got to figure out if that works for you. Charles Murray's book cuts so much and gives everybody about $8,000 and then a $2,000 healthcare voucher and also securities
per year. Yeah.
Yeah. So Murray managed to write a proposal that I don't want. Like, that's not easy, because I tend to think this idea is real powerful. Once it's implemented, we'll start to make it grow. You know, he managed to do that. So having a proposal that commits in the text, right? We'll reevaluate. We'll make sure that it's progressively funded. We'll make sure that majority of Americans and the least well-off are coming out ahead financially. Just set those into the bill. And I think that can assure people of much of what the project's going to do.
Yeah. I like that you brought up healthcare, because there's this very interesting parallel between socialized healthcare, Medicare for all, and basic income. So on the one hand, you have the question, should employers really be the ones who are providing everyone's healthcare? Should people right. have to depend on private employment in order to get healthcare, right? And then you can ask the same question about income. Why should people have to depend on private employers to get their money? And you'd think, you know, intuitively, if you're just kind of presented these ideas on their own, you might think that the people who support Medicare for all, or, you know, government-backed healthcare, would also support basic income for kind of the same logical reason. But I had an interesting Twitter exchange with someone the other day, and he was a supporter of socialized healthcare, and he was not a supporter of basic income. And he said that the reason he supported socialized healthcare was that it prevents businesses from spending money that would go to wages on healthcare. So the idea was that it was really important that people had wages. And if you took away the responsibility for businesses to provide healthcare for their employees, then they could provide more wages. So he was all in on wages. And from that perspective, basic income takes away from wages, or it's an alternative to wages, and he doesn't want that. So I thought that was very interesting, because it's he thinks about socialized healthcare in a very different way from the way I do as well.
It's very unusual for someone willing to use the word socialist, right? Because the idea that if you take away a responsibility from a corporation, and that will free up their money, and of course that will go to wages.
Right.
I mean, I just think of, you don't even have to be a socialist ordinarily, just, I don't know, look around a bit, frankly. So I don't fully get that. And I do know, I mean, I did a little bit of political work and some union work. A strike fund for all is what I say. That's my slogan when people challenge basic income from the left. That was Eric Olin Wright's phrase. And Eric Olin Wright, tremendous socialist credentials, but we will see people withdraw their labor and ask for better deals, and they will be able to do better while they're at it. We just saw one of the biggest strikes, the grocery strike here in Northeast, right?
Stop and Shop.
Yeah, Stop and Shop. And my town really rallied behind that. It was really fun to see that. They had to save up in order to continue to have some funds, right? They had to really build up to that point. It'll be easier if everyone's getting a basic income.
So here's a question. Why do we think that there are people on the left who, like, I think this guy on Twitter maybe was not using a standard argument. Maybe not a lot of people think the way he does. But there are a lot of people on the left who support Medicare for All, who do not support basic income. So what's the logic there? How can you justify one without also justifying the other? Let's go to Derek.
I'd really like to hear Jason's answer to that, but I found that, yeah, it's not that uncommon, although I notably these days I have noticed actually many more socialist arguments pro UBI than when I started out. When I started out, I mean, I'll never forget this experience I had, you know, hearing at a kind of political conference, hearing people listen to a friend of mine, Diane, give a presentation about basic income. There were some sort of, you know, anti-poverty advocates there who were vehemently against it. And I think, you know, for me, when I started to consider that basic income was possible, it raised a lot of questions in my mind. And I kind of intuitively sensed that there was a fundamental attitude about and ideas about money that we've had, I mean, in general, middle, right, and left, about money, like our attitudes about money, how we think it works, what we think it is. And so it immediately made me want to go question, well, what is money anyway? What is it for? How do we use it? And I think that's where I've started to get a little bit of clarity there about maybe, well, why we haven't done a basic income before, right? And why maybe there is this lingering opposition to the idea, because I mean, there's so many everyday assumptions that basic income kind of contradicts with. One assumption we have is that, well, you earn your money from wages for work. I mean, that's where we get our money from. And we're very upset normally, right, about people who get their money without working or who are perceived to get their money without working. That's actually behind a lot of the socialist arguments against the upper class, you know, that sort of thing. People who are perceived to, you know, fairly or unfairly perceived to be, you know, lounging about on money that they haven't earned through their work, right? And I remember when Andrew Yang started making these arguments, like he got some pushback. I remember people booing him at one event when he was suggesting handing out money to people for free. I think we've made a lot of progress since then. But yeah, I think that basic everyday assumptions about our economy, you know, money from wages, and the idea that, well, you know, fighting poverty has to do with, well, raising taxes, right? And then the government, you know, creates programs. Basic income is kind of the opposite of that. You're not, you know, you're actually giving money. The government's giving money back to people directly instead of removing it. So from our whole everyday assumptions, basic income is counterintuitive. And I think what that shows is that maybe those assumptions were wrong and we need to question them.
Yeah, it's very ingrained, this idea that people get their money from jobs, or like that's the normal way that people have to get their money in an economy. Let's go to Neil.
Okay, I continue to say that 2 years ago, I wrote an ad in the Washington Post, basically proposing a VAT to a dedicated VAT. To me, it had to be dedicated VAT to have all the proceeds except for some which were needed for anti-fraud and overhead, to dedicate the income from that for a basic income to everybody, and I got two feedbacks from that article, that ad. I can't put that in the Washington Post anymore. I get two feedbacks from that ad, and one of them was a good guy, I don't know, one of your group, who basically said, "Oh, that's an idea I hadn't thought of," and I'm wondering if Yang got my I'm the one who talked Yang into considering it. I still don't. I haven't gotten any feedback. I asked the Washington Post, and they haven't done anything. And I ask a lot of things, and I expect almost never will anything happen but occasionally. You throw 100 stones and maybe one hits something. So anyways, that was one. And then there's another fact which I've just been reading a book by an Indian, the two economists at MIT, which presented an idea which I hadn't thought, which is very unusual, because most ideas I've found one way or another. And basically he says that if you taxed the upper brackets an awful lot, if you make the tax rate back to 90%, 80%, who knows what, that actually you wouldn't cut the amount of work they did, but you might cut the salaries they got. And I found that very interesting. And his argument was very persuasive. The reason why what company is going to give, if most of the money goes to the government, why would you want to?
Yeah, that's right. And I think a lot of people, if they're CEOs and stuff like that, because of income tax, they take a lot of stock options and other kinds of benefits instead of income, because the income, or instead of just straight income, because the income is going to be taxed.
Well, there's a big problem there. We agree. And you'd have to finagle things. But in principle, I like his argument that I like this item, which I had never thought about, but there's very little lack of people work the same amount. If you pay the athlete $1 million, he does approximately the same amount of effort as the guy who gets $100,000.
Right.
It doesn't really, that isn't what motivates them.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is you're competing to get that person to do the effort for you. So there's kind of this bidding war on a particular person.
Right, exactly. But now how are you going to bid if the tax is so high? And if you do it right so that you can't avoid it one way or another.
Yeah.
Well, he had an interesting argument there. And I just found that an interesting argument. I wanted to have set up a VAT. And I told you my reason for the VAT.
Yeah.
And my reason was, I hope you could set it up so that everybody thinks they are entitled to some amount of money from that VAT. And so that when a conservative got in power and decided that a basic income was that there should be a much more of a class structure, and it basically is a bad idea, then I was thinking, oh, this is due like Roosevelt did for Social Security. You've earned it. You paid all these goods. Well, you're taking this away from me.
I would definitely encourage you to watch our discussion. We did an entire one of these on the value-added tax. So we talked about value-added tax for 2 hours, which was fun. In terms of Andrew Yang, maybe he partly got his idea a little bit from you. Who knows, right? I know that his primary influence was a guy named Andy Stern, who wrote a book called Raising the Floor. And that's where he got most of his idea from. The first time I met Andrew Yang was at an event up in New Hampshire. And I asked him why he chose $1,000 a month. And he said, it wasn't my idea, I got it from Andy Stern. That was literally his answer to my question. And in terms of the VAT in general, Jason was talking before about Mike Huckabee's fair tax plan. So if you have a sales tax, that's basically equivalent to a VAT. So these two things are kind of the same thing as each other. So there have been the fair tax thing has been around for quite a while. So it's kind of been in the air. And VAT in particular is something that is a very common form of tax around the world. So I appreciate if you're putting ads in the Washington Post, that certainly helps get the message out.
I just wanted to say the great argument, I don't know if you had this argument, you can make the VAT much more efficient in terms of overhead than you can for most other tax policies.
Yeah, that's right.
And you can make it much harder. You can make it much harder to cheat.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So let's get to another quote from the article. Left-wing organizations should make a basic income part of their left-wing project. Left-wingers that denounce basic income as neoliberal are refusing to de-link the policy from a rival project. They should write out what sorts of basic income they would support and condemn the powers that be for not securing economic independence for all. free market enthusiasts, I'm not calling them right wing, should make a basic income part of their free market project. Those that denounce a basic income as socialist or communist are refusing to de-link the policy from a rival project. They need basic income if they care about extending the benefits of markets to everyone. So I think this is the kind of the Lego argument at its core, that it fits into whatever you're trying to do and makes it better. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, so myself personally, I definitely would like to see a more left-wing implementation. You know, I think the further right you go, you know, the more you cut programs. And I think that's acceptable to some extent, you know, if we're talking means-tested programs specifically. A lot of them, you know, you have the welfare cliffs and they don't cover that many people. And I think those would be better if they were cash. Yeah, and, you know, talking to some of those objections, you know, from the left, those are definitely some of the ones that I encountered first. I was very surprised by. But I think for me personally, that's been very good because it meant that I had to really think about how I was talking about basic income. And to be able to talk about it better, I had to understand it better. And so towards the end of the campaign, you know, I was still a big fan of Andrew Yang, but I felt like there are a lot of places where he could improve his messaging. Everyone likes money. And so it's definitely fun with that sort of proposal to talk about, you know, we're going to throw out money to everybody. But I think that in terms of policy it's better messaging for a campaign than it is for a policy, I think. So I think that sort of attitude contributed to some of the skepticism on the left, just like, oh, we've got all these problems, we'll just throw some money at people and it'll be fine. And so really, I think you need to stress that, you know, we're not just trying to raise everyone's incomes a little bit. It's not about the money, it's about what the money is going to do. And so the goal is, you know, to guarantee an economic floor under everyone, to guarantee everyone basic economic rights, you know, to restore those rights that we lost when the commons were privatized. And I think when you put it in that sort of message, that makes it clear that you're really thinking about the problems that people face and how we're going to solve them. I think you get a lot more support that way if you demonstrate that you're thinking about it critically and that you actually understand what your goals are and how basic income will help achieve them.
Yeah, I like your point about being able to talk about basic income and fit it into kind of whatever perspective or whatever narrative the person you're engaging with has. It might've been a little bit trickier for Andrew Yang because he's always speaking to such a broad audience. He's not necessarily just sitting down one-on-one with people. So we kind of had to pick a message that was going to alienate some people. Did he pick the best one? I probably agree with you that he did not, but then there's plenty of disagreement to be had about what the best broad message for basic income is. And I like Jason's point about keeping it generic and just really sticking to the core of what basic income is. It's free money for everyone. It's emphasizing that, you know, we're throwing money at the problem might sound like an oversimplification, so you probably don't want to frame it like that, but really just keeping to the core of what it is and allowing people to fit it in to whatever their politics are. I like to emphasize that basic income is about the money, but, you know, the money is important and the way we get people money in our economy has to work efficiently in order for other things to work. So let's go to Bethany. Yeah, are you ready?
I think so. To go back to your point about healthcare and why it's different from basic income. And I thought one important factor is that a lot of other countries already have national healthcare. And I do think that changes the conversation because people still, despite that, make many of the same kinds of arguments that they would make against basic income, like it might be more efficient to just fill in the gaps, right? That's still an argument that you see, like instead of going to national healthcare, let's just fill in the gaps. I see that as somewhat analogous to arguments against basic income that say, let's just target our money more efficiently towards the people that actually need it, as opposed to, you know, sort of fill in the gaps that way. So I think that, I don't know, but if other countries didn't have national, you know, if it was unheard of to have national healthcare, we might see even more of that kind of thing. And we might see a discussion that looks a lot more similar to the discussion around basic income, because as many people pointed out, a lot of it is just the novelty of the idea. And instead we have most major nations across the world have national health insurance. And yet we still see some of the same arguments, but it definitely changes the conversation and of course makes it seem like a more widespread idea. And that's natural. We see that it's not totally just, you know, destructive or problematic in these other countries. And seems to work well. So I think that's a huge factor in that difference.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it makes me wonder if there's a way to use the fact that government-backed healthcare is this very common, normal thing and draw an analogy with basic income and help people feel more familiar with the idea of basic income by drawing that comparison. And I think people were saying, or Matt was mentioning before, one of the criticisms from the left is that you're oversimplifying and you're just throwing money at problems. And it's funny because basic income is this very simple thing. And if you just look at all the complicated problems we have and someone comes in with this very simple solution, it looks like an oversimplification. Like you've got all this complicated stuff going on and you're saying, oh, let's just do this really simple, easy thing. But the problem is there's this really simple thing that's broken in our economy and it's causing all these other problems. So I don't know what the trick is to kind of see that the simplicity is actually a big part of what makes it powerful. Let's go to Eddie.
So I really liked what Derek was talking about. And I think that from the left argument, the way I understand their thinking is that, I think there's some influence of Marxism there, and that the leftist idea is that the production of society is created by the labor of the workers, that it comes from work. And so, and then they believe that capitalists actually steal part of that production from the workers. And so if you believe that, then it's natural to think that if you just give people money, then people are going to stop working and you'll get less production. And so it's actually a coherent, system of thought. If you think that production comes from labor, then if you give people money, many people work less and then production is going to go down and you're just going to get inflation. That would actually make sense if you thought that, if that were right, but it's not, even though it's not right. And the funny thing is that the people on the right, they argue, they actually agree with the people on the left. They both agree that work justifies, kind of earnings, what you get from society. And the right says that, I have so much money because I worked so hard. I worked really, really hard. And that's why I have so much money. And these people on the left, they just want to get the money without working. So, they're kind of actually both in the same, they both agree that money comes from working, or earnings, benefits from society comes from working. And they're both accusing the other of trying to not work. I think that they're actually both, I think that there's like some trauma from the, from the Cold War era there, where people can't talk about it openly. And the thing is that, we need to get past that and realize that production is a product of capital, of labor and capital. And the capital is kind of a form of accumulating that labor. It's kind of a form of working smarter, not harder. It's a form of working one day and being able to have that benefit you for the rest of your life, instead of, doing work that you repeat today and then you have to do it again tomorrow and then you have to do it again the day after and so on. I mean, that's the most powerful force in society today. And basic income is just the way to take full advantage of that and set up our economy like Alex likes talks about, in a way that actually works. And to do that, we have to get past this idea that work justifies earnings, because there's capital in there too. Yeah,
or even the idea that money has to be something you earn. Is basic income something that people have to earn? Is it something that people have to deserve in order to give it to them? Or is it just, people need to buy things. We want people to be able to buy what the economy produces. And so you give them money so they can do that. And we want to support people, right? There's a lot of, moralizing and, discussion of who deserves what in these kinds of conversations. Let's go to Dan.
Yes, everybody's making really, really great points. I'm trying to respond to each one kind of briefly. I think in terms of the messaging, universalist messaging is definitely the best way to go. And I definitely agree that I don't think Andrew Yang necessarily picked the best message. best way to message basic income. But I do think one thing that he did well was to kind of universalize it and focus on how this would benefit everybody. And even with the value-added tax, that's something that, you know, applies across the economy, as opposed to saying we're going to fund a basic income with a wealth tax, which brings in different sorts of challenges and things like that. And so universalist messaging is important. One of my favorite phrases related to what you were getting at, Alex, with sort of the problems in society is, you know, that basic income doesn't solve every problem, but it makes every problem easier to solve. And I think that's a very good, apolitical, general, universal way to frame it that can speak to a lot of different people. And kind of related to that, one of the things that I've been thinking about is thinking about basic income as a human rights sort of thing. I think I've touched on that in a couple of our meetings. And it's similar to, you know, the argument that Bernie Sanders made for Medicare for All, and I think that worked very well, that health insurance is a right and not, you know, a benefit of your job or a privilege or something like that. And so I think if you frame basic income, you know, having access to a basic amount of income as a human right, you know, I think that can land a little more. I have used that in one discussion with somebody that I worked with when talking about it. And then my last kind of point was related to sort of the ideologies and, you know, with left-wing ideology in terms of, you know, more extreme sort of hardcore communist or Marxist views. I think there's a lot of, from what I can tell, emphasis on kind of punishment. And I think taxation is sort of the preferred method. I think a lot of people see, maybe from, you know, the taxation, like collecting the taxes as being, the person who's being taxed might feel like they're being punished, and it might be from the person who wants to tax someone else. It's like, we can't do, like, you're hoarding all this money, and so, and we can't do these other things because you're hoarding all this money, and so we need to take it from you. And so there's this sort of kind of exclusionist or exclusion versus inclusion sort of thing going on, I think, with basic income, where it's like, are you more concerned with punishing rich people or helping poor people? Like, what's your sort of focus? Because to me, if your focus is helping, you know, it's related to the first quote, if your focus is helping poor people, then the universality of basic income should be, that shouldn't be an issue as much as it is for a lot of people. Like, why should rich people get it? That's, you know, one of the most common arguments against it. And sort of that's a sensitivity to inclusion, like including people who don't need it. And so I think that's also a good way to respond to those sort of more, I would say, more left-wing arguments. And then, you know, related to that with the sort of safety net. And it's like, once you have a basic income, we should just ask, do certain programs still make sense to have in a world with basic income, as opposed to, you know, we're going to have a basic income, but to have a basic income, we need to get rid of these programs. And just saying, like, let's do this and then review what we might want to keep or get rid of because it no longer makes sense, not because it's somehow immoral or it's wasteful or something like that. So getting rid of the judgment aspect of it and just being like, is this effective still in a world with basic income, and being, you know, sort of, you know, going two or three steps ahead and seeing like how people react to that. If you say like, is SNAP, you know, does SNAP make sense in a world with basic income? So yeah, that was kind of rambly, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, does SNAP make sense in a world where everyone has enough money to buy all the food they need, right? I think that's a really good point. And, you know, there's a huge difference between having your goal be to destroy all the welfare programs and destroy all the safety net programs, and then using basic income to achieve that goal. That's what Milton Friedman wanted to do, right? You know, there's a talk he gives where someone asks him a question later, and he's like, well, why do you support a negative income tax? And he literally says, well, it's a way to consolidate all the welfare programs into one thing, and then we can eliminate it, right? So that's obviously not the direction that I think most people here want to go. But it's certainly, you know, if we talk about Jason's article, you know, people who are really maybe against basic income for these kind of Marxian class conflict, we want to punish the rich kind of reasons, they will look for a project like that uses basic income integrated into it as an argument against basic income, even if that's not their original reason to be averse to the basic income in the first place. Let's go to Jake.
Hey, yeah, so I've got this little Lego guy here. I'm not sure you can see it. But yeah, I just, so some of the people that I talked about basic income, they push back. I mean, less so now, but in the beginning it was like, look, like we don't want people to just be dependent on government. Like you give people money, they'll be dependent on government. And it sounds like a good argument, sort of, it sounded good at first, but then it's like, wait a second, like, what do you think, like, are you an independent, like sovereign man right now? Like, give me a break. Like we're all already dependent on government as it stands right now. Like, you know, fresh water, roads, traffic lights that work, you know, a system of laws, however unevenly applied they are. So I'm sort of sitting here thinking right now, like maybe we think about, because I actually have a problem with framing it as a human right. I think like, and maybe Jason, I studied philosophy in college, but maybe Jason can like talk a bit more, just this idea of like a human right, like I'm owed it. It's like, I think Bernie had some problems with that, framing it like that. Like, wait, I'm a doctor, I have to give you healthcare? Like, what if I don't want to? So I think the human right language is fraught with landmines, but I think like basic income as infrastructure could be interesting. Yeah. Like it's just table stakes now. It's the same as clean drinking water. We don't have drinking water because it's a human right, but we all kind of, you know, it's kind of this gray area. We all kind of agreed like, yeah, this is a good idea. And I think that kind of a model might be able to get through to some of these cracks that are opening in people's minds.
Yeah, I like that. And you know, when people say they don't want everybody to be dependent on the government, you know, you make a really good point, which is that nobody is independent or self-sufficient. And if we all tried to be self-sufficient, that would be incredibly inefficient, right? We're all dependent on society. And the question is, do we want to be dependent on private employers or do we want to be dependent on the government? And that's more the government's role. If you're trying to get employers to take care of the people, that's the government kind of foisting their responsibility onto the private sector. So you're always going to have dependence. You can't get away from that. It's what are you going to be dependent on? And what are you going to be independent from? If you're independent from, you know, a labor market that is maybe not going to pay you well or not going to promote your survival, that sounds like a great thing to me. You're independent from the right thing. And if the only thing you're depending on is the government, well, that's the government's job. That sounds pretty efficient to me as well.
Well, just one heads up is just like, let's be aware of the pitfalls that like all the greatest atrocities in human history have been done by governments.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
So let's be aware that that's a pitfall and then proceed accordingly. Like, let's not use, you know, the Nazis as a reason to say, let's destroy government instead of try some basic income idea. So I'm just gonna, like, be aware of the pitfalls.
Right. I think that's a great point. We need to govern well. If you have kind of this centralized authority and that fails to be effective, or, you know, does something really bad, then there's not really any recourse you have because everyone's dependent on this single central point of failure. So there's kind of this trade-off between efficiency and kind of redundancy. If your employer sucks, you can go find another employer, hypothetically, if, you know, the market's working the way it's supposed to. But you can't necessarily go find another government if you're dependent on the government. So I think that's a really good point. We do need to keep that in mind. Yeah, let's go to Derek.
I really like everything Jake just said. And I think Alex's point earlier pointing out about the whole Milton Friedman thing and using basic income to achieve this other end, right? I think that's relates to Jason's article and maybe the pitfalls of there's a difference between, you know, arguing for basic income in a way that's sort of compatible with people's different visions, but then you can get run into trouble when, like, if you're in a debate with someone and you kind of allow them to take basic income in that direction, you cede territory that you might not want to. And I think those kind of arguments and those projects, those sort of what we might call, what's the word? They're partisan projects, right? That they're using basic income for. That might be why we haven't had basic income. If maybe Friedman laid off of that language and just talked about the negative income tax benefits, we'd have a negative income tax and that would have transitioned into a basic income. The same thing with the Democrats in the 1970s. And so, yeah, we need to be wary of that. And so I guess that's sort of just my explanation of kind of how originally coming at this more from the political and philosophical standpoint and the right standpoint, I've slid into talking about the economics because I can always kind of go there and bypass those questions. Like, well, you know, whether it's a right or not, is it possible and is it been optimal? Is it beneficial for the economy, which is this thing that we all participate in and kind of can't avoid, right? So yeah, I like the basic income as infrastructure and just like questioning what people think about money, like what is money, how do we feel about it, right? And bringing the conversation there is not the whole story, but I found that it's useful.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I should point out that I don't think Milton Friedman was volunteering this position and using this as his main message for supporting negative income tax. What happened was he had given a big talk about immigration and he really wanted open borders. And he thought that open borders were incompatible with the welfare state. So he had previously said that he supported negative income tax, and one of the audience members kind of cornered him and questioned him on this. So that was the answer he gave in response. I don't think he was voluntarily like using this as a way of selling the negative income tax. Let's go to Eddie.
I was thinking that, it's like with the accumulation of capital, society has gotten richer and richer, but we're still stuck saying that you have to earn your money. But as capital increases, that just gets harder and harder to do. And so you end up with this extraordinarily rich society that still has poor people because we're trying to force them to do something which is not actually, you know, really possible.
Yeah.
Or not really, you know, really very plausible with the enormous amount of capital that we that society now has.
Yeah, it's the poverty among plenty problem that Henry George used to talk about a lot. Let's go to Dan.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to Jake, and I think that I appreciate that pushback on the human rights framing. The reason I'm curious what we think about how we define a right, or maybe not necessarily a human right, because I think sort of the poster child of the right that we have in the US is free speech, like the First Amendment. And to me, the understanding of a right is something that you have and it can't be taken away from you. And so I think that framing can work. This is part of the messaging thing too. I think that framing can work better with people with a more left political persuasion. And I do think the infrastructure might work better with people with a more right-leaning persuasion, but that's kind of why I was thinking about it in those terms, because it seems like if you don't have it in that space, then there's always political reasons that people can come up with, or there's other reasons that people can come up with to push against it or try to say why this shouldn't be in existence, especially if we think, and I think most of us here do, that it should be a basic income should be implemented by the government, which means that it's always in that. And if it would require legislation to do that, there's always the possibility that another political apparatus can come in and say, we don't like this, we want to get rid of it. And they can come up with all these reasons why they want to get rid of it. But if it's in the realm of human rights, or like with other countries where we talk about with healthcare, where it's this thing that's so ingrained in the culture and everybody just doesn't even question its existence, that it's not politically, it's not a political landmine. It's politically bulletproof. So yeah, it's just my response to that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. What kinds of things make a policy hard to get rid of? So Jason brought up Social Security earlier, and that's something that kind of touches everyone. You're going to get it later, probably, if you worked. I might not get very much. But most people are going to get it later, and everyone knows people who are getting it. So it's kind of something that everybody understands and can relate to. Whereas a lot of social benefit programs are something that other people get. Basic income is not like that. Basic income is more like Social Security. So my intuition is that once it's in place, very quickly it will become something that people kind of take for granted, and it will be very, very hard to get rid of. Now, the question of whether it should be made a human right or not, I think everybody's brought up some good points. Derek brought up the point that a lot of it depends on what's possible. I think that was Derek. So the question is it possible to give everyone a basic income? Then it's possible to make basic income a human right and implement it as a human right. But if it's not possible, you can declare it as a human right. I mean, there's something similar to basic income in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's not basic income, but they say that, you know, everyone should have enough income to survive or live a decent life. I don't know what the language is or something like that. That was written back in 1948. And we did not achieve that. Like, we declared it as a human right, but people aren't getting that. There's still widespread poverty in the world. Now, that's not to say that it wasn't possible to do a basic income back then. Maybe it was, or a high enough basic income to kind of meet those criteria. I think maybe it was, but we didn't. So even if you use the language of a human right, that kind of thing, you still have to justify it on how feasible is it. So I think that's something to kind of keep in mind. So the language of human rights, maybe it can help reinforce it and help make it harder to take away or something like that. But I think it's not ultimately what's going to get us over the hump. We have to convince people that this is something that is doable, that works, that is compatible with a functional society, with a functional economy, that kind of thing. Or we just have to kind of gradually do it bit by bit and then discover that, oh, this works, this is great, we want to do more of it.
I think that's exactly what I was getting at. I was thinking of it as a framing device to help discuss it, talk about it, get people more interested in thinking about it and going, because yeah, I agree that there's a lot of things we have that are labeled as, you know, human rights or whatever that aren't necessarily universal.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I also think it's important to keep in mind that the more complicated and diverse we make our arguments for basic income, our basic income supporting arguments, the easier it's going to be for opponents to poke holes in it. You know, we create a larger attack surface, as it were. So if we keep it simple and we really focus on the Lego itself and just the core definition of what it is, that makes it harder to shoot down as an idea. So with that, let's go to another quote from the article. There is another way to think about basic income. This is an idea that gets in your head. Once you realize that it is mostly a question of political will, you start to think about how different the world would be if everyone had a share. You start to wonder how different schools would be. You start to wonder how different political life would be, how different the art world and the sport world would be. So I like this. I like this imagining of what the world would be like with a basic income. And I particularly like it because I'm going to be giving a speech on Saturday at the Boston Basic Income Rally. It's not our rally, it's not a Boston Basic Income Rally, but it's a basic income rally in Boston, where I talk about imagining what the world would be like if we had a basic income. And Jason's going to be giving a speech there too. So either come in person or watch the live stream, it's going to be great. But I think, you know, there's an interesting question here. Is basic income, or whether we're going to have basic income, is it mostly a question of political will? And I would probably push back against that. I think there's a lot more here than political will. And starting in 2013, I was getting frustrated with how people were talking about basic income on the intellectual side. And I think there's a lot of areas where we can improve and do more work to make basic income more accepted. Go ahead, Bethany.
Hearing you say that, I wonder what you think of basic income being implemented without the kind of understanding that you would like people to have. So you think that behind the scenes it could work anyway. Do you think that would still have a lot of pitfalls, like the amount might be wrong or be managed poorly, you know, without the right economic understanding? Or do you think people could kind of blunder into it and it would still make things a lot better, even if the economic understanding wasn't what you would want it to be? Or maybe it's a little of both, but I'm curious what you think of that.
Yes, I think it's all of that. I think it's a lot of both. I think if we stumble into basic income, we're going to start discovering the things that we need to discover to optimize it for our society. If we discover those things ahead of time, then we can go into basic income with our eyes open, and that's great too. So I wouldn't say we shouldn't stumble into it, or we shouldn't follow the mainstream arguments for basic income if that path takes us to an actual implementation of basic income. I certainly wouldn't make that argument. Go ahead, Eddie.
Oh, I think a lot of things end up being stumbled into. As I mentioned earlier, I think like Social Security was kind of a version of stumbling into a solution without necessarily understanding why it worked to bring us out of the Depression. I was reading the other day about the Depression of, I think it was the 1840s. And at the time, there was no monetary policy. It was a gold standard. And in 1848, we had the California Gold Rush. So at the time, gold was money. We discovered a bunch of gold. So we had accidental monetary expansion that brought us out of a depression in the 1840s. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's really funny. Accidental monetary policy. Let's go to Derek.
Well, that's funny because that's sort of what basic income could be. And I mean, I agree with Alex that stumbling into it is good, and that can be healthy, and we'll learn more of what we need to learn. I guess one advantage though of trying to take the kind of more harder macroeconomic, like resource based view, is that you realize that a lot of the things that will make it difficult to stumble into it are not necessarily necessary, right? So if you're making your basic income proposal conditional upon, one, like a certain amount that you're committed to in advance, and two, raising taxes on people a lot in order to not only pay for it. And well, if you meet objections on one of those fronts, then that might delay the implementation of it. Whereas if you were going to look at it from a macroeconomic standpoint and say, well, it's kind of like monetary policy, let's introduce a little bit of it and then see what happens and then raise it again, you know, next month, that baby step would be easy to implement. And then you would bypass that whole thing about taxation. Then the question on tax would be like, oh, what tax policy allows us to increase it, right? So there's a trade-off. Like, I think it's harder for people to actually get their heads around that version of it, but it does sidestep a lot of the hot button political disputes around taxation and around whether we should or have to remove other welfare policies. It lets you go right by that.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, a question we could ask is, you know, what level of basic income could our economy handle right now? And last week, Neil and I got into an exchange about this, about, you know, whether you could gradually increase the basic income and calibrate it to the optimal level for the economy or something like that. And Neil pointed out that you're liable to overshoot, undershoot, that kind of thing. You're not going to get it perfect. But it's also important to keep in mind that if we have zero basic income, we are perpetually undershooting, right? So we know that increasing it a little bit is going to help. Eventually you get to a point where you might overshoot and then you might undershoot, that kind of thing. But it being in that position where you're trying to get it right and you're not getting it quite right is much better than the position that we're in now, if you believe that you want people to have access to the economy from a basic income. So we're getting to the end. I want to do one more quote from the article, and then we'll go around and get people's final thoughts, and we will end on Jason. First, here's the quote from the article. So this is the end of the article. Lots of people are saying that they think basic income is great, and then they get challenged to produce a proposal or to spell out their project. I want to see more basic income policy proposals out there. I want to see more people make basic income part of their projects. But we also need to see people saying the world would be better if we did this. We need to get as many people as we can to say that's a powerful idea. And I like that. I think that's a great way to end this article. And I really enjoyed this article. So let's go around. We'll start with Derek and then Bethany and then Richard.
I think that ending paragraph is a great way to close it out. And I have to say, like, you know, as someone who supports a particular policy proposal, like, I'm never mad whenever I see anyone arguing for a different basic income proposal. For me, very, very much from the beginning, getting on board with the Andrew Yang stuff, like, as if you were talking about basic income, you were ahead of the game, in my view. And I'm just glad to see that more people are talking about it. And I know the more people are talking about it, even if it's the way it's introduced is sort of, you know, harder and non-optimal. I mean, it gets us going in the right direction. And I think you know, I'm actually fairly hopeful about it. And I'm looking forward to seeing how the conversation develops.
Okay, thanks, Derek. Let's go to Bethany and then Richard.
Yeah, great discussion. I still feel like I have a lot of mystery around the question you posed, Alex, of like what path would basic income take to make it to be a sort of a mainstream policy or a government policy. So I'm curious to see which way things go, but I thought this was really interesting.
Okay, let's go Richard and then Jake.
Well, I think a shotgun approach is a lot better than just the single bullet. So if you have a whole bunch of different arguments, then it's a lot easier to find one that sticks or hits than if you just fire a rifle shot and you miss or you hit. There's a whole bunch of space that you can miss at.
Okay, so you're pushing back against me a little bit there. Let's go to Jake, Eddie, and then Joan.
Yeah, so awesome discussion as always. Super thought-provoking. This morning I was watching Jerome Powell's, you know, the chairman of the Fed's, his little speech, and he's talking about, you know, the economy will recover quickly. I'm sitting there being like, what the heck is the economy? Like just this whole idea of like, what are we even talking about here? Like, people are like in longest lines ever outside of like food banks. People are going to get evicted. Bezos made $100 billion. Like, what is the economy? And so I think, yeah, just more conversations like this, you know, these are really helpful. And that's kind of my closing thought.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll leave it there.
Thanks, Jake. Let's go to Eddie, Joan, and then Dan.
So I think there's an analogy here of politics, where it's like, if you're married and you have a wife, sometimes you may come upon something that your wife wants, and you want the same thing, but for different reasons. And, you know, when that happens, you don't necessarily have to argue with her that she has the wrong reason or whatever. If you both wanted the same thing, then we're all good. And I think politics kind of works like that a lot. You have so many different people with so many different ideas, and sometimes, you know, a lot of different groups align wanting the same thing for different reasons, and that's fine. I think that's how a lot of stuff happens.
Okay. Let's go to Joan and then Dan, and then we'll finish with Jason.
Yeah, thanks for the great discussion. It feels like a lot of things were brought together, and as usual, provocative. Thanks, Alex. Thank you, Jason, for coming.
Okay, Dan and then Jason.
Yep, another great discussion. And I guess just the one quick final point. I think basic income is something that'll have to be sort of voted in. And so sort of by that token, you're kind of voting on a policy proposal that a person running wants to implement. I don't know how general you can be in the political space. It's kind of difficult a lot of times. I wish it were not like that, but it seems to be that way. But yeah, great discussion.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Jason, go ahead. You got a little bit of time.
Thank you. It's real exciting to see a close reading of the article. And actually, the passages you selected are my favorite from that. It was fun to see those in bold. I'm going to switch to another topic a little bit, to some of what I think is coming up right now. We're seeing new political alignments. So when I wrote some of that article, we were seeing people on the right trying to figure out the future of their political movement. And so we're seeing Heritage Foundation, and by the way, I was not part of that or benefiting from it. So I heard they were hosting forums on basic income. That has been dropped. There's very little, I mean, it's hard to find it. Like, I find it so I can put it on Facebook to be provocative. And it's largely disappeared because the right-wing project is not a really theoretical one at the moment because of its leadership. Some of that may be to a situation, merely cutting taxes did happen, right? That happened with the Republican Senate, but that's yielding less and less. So it's just, there's not so much more you can cut, right? So they're having to figure out what are the things we can do to make sure people work and work cheaply. So if that's the new right-wing project, pushing people into work, which explains a lot of some of the COVID policy we're seeing, basic income is going to get harder to find. in the right. It's not going to disappear, because, and we should talk to folks who are honest representatives of that movement, but it's been harder to find, even though the idea has spread. The other alignment that's interesting, it's not a strict one, it's not 100% official yet, but we're seeing now within the Democratic Party, a left group, a centrist group, and then some Democrats who don't really play that, they're kind of doing their own thing. But there's a commitment on the part of Justice Democrats, it's an organization, Democratic Socialists of America, to run people against incumbents. And this was considered tremendously controversial. And the idea, no one should do that, right? That just works for the Republicans. No one should, you know, leave them alone in the primary. And I think that's about to disappear here in Massachusetts, right? Pelosi endorsed Kennedy against Markey. And I really don't mind that. I think we ought to have contested primaries. And I wish that that election had been centrist versus progressive. It was more, he's no good, no, he's no good. You know, it, the endorsements stacked along those lines, which, you know, helped bring some clarity to that election. How's that going to affect the basic income movement? I think the left is a source of more hope than some of our discussion indicated. I was a member a long time of Democratic Socialists of America. In the 90s, people just liked it. You'd mentioned it, they liked it. But now the chance for the left to grow as a movement was provided by Bernie Sanders. Sanders waits until there's a mass movement for a progressive policy before he backs it. He's not the kind of guy who finds an issue and then converts people, as Yang did with basic income. I can't imagine any way Yang could have improved what he did. I sat with him. I did an interview with him. It's on the same website as that paper. And I even turned off the interview for a second and just said a little bit about value-added tax. I wanted him to have some time to convince me of it. And he just said, I'm just looking for ways to get money from Amazon and Netflix and some of these guys, right? And if there's another way, I'll look for it. So that helped. That helped me. But I think if you're on the left and Bernie's your guy and he just doesn't talk about basic income, if you asked him about it, he tended to say, yeah, that's good. And then he listed about six things that need to happen first. And then there's this guy running against him, right, who's all basic income all the time, right? So just a lot of people were figuring this isn't left because this guy's not for it. But the next group coming in, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have simply said they like basic income. So, and then we have Kamala Harris talking about $2,000 a month throughout COVID.
Right.
So those are, and I count her as a centrist, right? So we have two groups that might back basic income, might not. Yang's Humanity Forward endorsed challengers against incumbents. By the way, that's very unselfish of Yang, because that somebody told him, I wasn't in the room, I'm just guessing this, but I really believe that somebody told him, well, look, if you want to get in the cabinet or get one of those jobs, don't encourage people to run against the chair of that Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal, who's in the congressional district next to mine. That's not how you do this. But he did. He endorsed the opponent, Alex Morris, who endorsed basic income. So what we might have here is a third group within the Democrats, and we might have a group of voters that start thinking, look, left is your label, centrist is your label, which one's Elizabeth Warren? Is she left? Is she centrist? You know what? I don't care. Who wants basic income?
Right.
And that group could become very, very powerful, pass their numbers within the party. They could be picking primary winners right and left. And if we vote for Proposition 2 in Massachusetts, by the way, which has, you know, ranked choice voting, we could have people who support basic income running and our second choices be other supporters. And as we could become even more powerful because we have an angle. And I think that's why I am hugely optimistic about the future of this movement, because if we have another year, if we grow as much next year, over the next 2 years as we did the last 2 years, we're going to have a basic income. Now, we won't grow that much, but we're going to grow. We're definitely going to grow. And so things like this are more fertile, more powerful. I mean, I know they're interesting. I've really enjoyed all this, by the way. But it's not just interesting. Yeah, remember you were here, right? Because I think how this goes next is going to be influenced by discussions like this one.
I love it. Yeah, I mean, it's exciting to feel like we're a part of this. And, you know, I always, you know, welcome anyone in here who has any position on basic income, whether they're for or against. But, you know, just getting people to talk about it, right? You know, there are people who are talking about it who didn't know what it was. There are a lot of people who are talking about it who didn't know what it was. Maybe they're not for it, or you know, they haven't made up their mind, but the fact that it's part of the conversation. And then, you know, I think I think that's a very optimistic note to end on. And I'm curious, you wrote that article over 4 years ago. How were you feeling then? Like, if we asked you the same question then, like, what are basic income's prospects? What do you see happening in the next 2 years or something like that? What would you have said?
I thought it was going to grow, but I didn't think we would have, I thought we would have some messier, I thought the first real national presence, I thought was likely to be messier than Yang, right? So when Mitt Romney and I can't remember the senator from Colorado backed, say, a baby bond, I thought, well, that's, we're going to have to rally behind that and say, that's good. You give them $1,000 when they're born, and whatever it's worth later, they get to have it. But how about basic income? I thought we were going to have to do more of that. So that was a stroke. We needed that.
Yeah.
And I kept looking around for something like the income movement, which exists now, because we had other pieces, but we didn't have an activist piece and the kind of wonkish policy piece. Economic Policy Institute and Humanity Forward just wasn't there. And a lot of people thought U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network was
You mean
was
Economic
there.
Security Project?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, yeah. You're right, Economic Policy Institute's, I don't think they have basic income, that's a liberal group. But the, so a lot of people thought U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network, which was a conference, academics, was kind of a bad version of an activist organization or a bad version of a DC lobby. Like, why aren't you doing this and that? And so now that those exist, we can say, well, if that's what you're after, hey, head over there. Yeah. And I'm amplifying a lot of that work as best I can, but I still believe in this intellectual component. In part, I find when people oppose it, they often start naming the things they like better. And a lot of that stuff, I think we need more of. So, you know, more, I would like to see basic income alongside a fast expansion of education, health, and cultural provisions. So, and it's only 4% of the GDP, right? We can, that's, I'm more, I have an easier time, the idea that we really need to get it right and think it through. I think I'm more lackadaisical. I'm less less cautious because it is 4% of the GDP. And if the Marxists are right, then you can Marxify 96% of it. You can have all that. Or, hey, Friedman, if you're right, you can have the rest of it. You know, we'll still have the same arguments, but why do we have to have that argument about this 4% that secures us independence, which I see as the goal? I probably use rights language for that, right?
Yeah.
That independence. Again, I mean, think how much better Europe, there's just no place I can see that wouldn't be improved by this level of independence.
Yeah. And I like what Eddie said about wanting the same thing for different reasons able to find a way to make it happen. So with that, our time is basically up. Next week, our topic is money shame. So why do we have a culture of shame around money, shame and secrecy? And we have featured guest Conrad Shaw coming in to talk to us about it. So I'm looking forward to that. Thanks, Jason, for being our featured guest tonight. And thanks, everybody.
I'm going to be there. Conrad Shaw is great, by the way.